She realized that the first day and night with him, spent alone and uninterrupted, was exceptional. She realized also that he must have set the time aside for her, and it must have been difficult to do so, for there were others, hundreds of others, demanding his attention. He was like one of the ancient African kings holding tribal court on the veranda of the old house. There were always men and women waiting patiently under the blue gum trees in the yard for their turn to speak to him. They were of all types and ages, from simple, uneducated folk newly arrived from the reserves in the country, to sophisticated lawyers and businessmen in dark suits arriving at Puck's Hill in their own automobiles. They had one thing in common only: the deference and respect they showed Moses Gama. Some of them clapped their hands in the traditional greeting and called him Baba or Inkosi, Father or Lord. Others shook his hand in the European manner, but Moses greeted each of them in their own dialect. He must speak 20 languages, Tara wondered. Mostly he allowed Tara to sit quietly beside his table, and he explained her presence with a quiet word. She is a friend. You may speak. However, twice he asked her to leave while he spoke to his more important visitors, and once, when a great black bull of a man, bald and scarred and gap-toothed, arrived in a shiny new Ford sedan, he excused them. This is Hendrik Tabaka, my brother, he said, and the two of them left the veranda and strolled side by side in the sunlit garden, just out of earshot of where Tara sat. What she saw during those days impressed her immensely and confirmed her feelings of reverence for this man. Everything he did, every word he uttered, marked him as different. And the respect and adulation showered upon him by his fellow Africans proved that they also recognized that he was the giant of the future. Tara felt awed that he had selected her for special attention, and yet already saddened by the certain knowledge that she could never have for herself alone any part of him. He belonged to his people, and she must be grateful for the precious grains of his time which she could glean for herself. Even the evenings that followed, unlike that first evening, were crowded with people and events. Until long after midnight, they sat at the table in the kitchen, sometimes as many as 20 of them, at one time, smoking and laughing and eating and talking. Such talk, such ideas that lit the gloomy room and shimmered like angels' wings in the air around their heads. Then later, in the quiet dark hours, they made love, and she felt as though her body no longer belonged to her, but that he had taken it for his own and devoured it like some darkly beloved predator. She must have met 100 new faces in those 3 short days and nights, and though some of them were hazy and made little lasting impression, it seemed as though she had become a member of a large, diffuse new family. And because of the patronage of Moses Gama, she was immediately accepted and accorded complete, unquestioning trust by both black and white. On the last evening before her return to the dream world at Weltevrieden, there was a guest beside her at the kitchen table to whom Tara took an instant, unqualified liking. She was a young woman, at least 10 years junior to Tara, barely into her 20s, but with an unusual maturity for one so young. "My name is Victoria Dinizulu," she introduced herself. "My friends call me Vicky. I know you are Mrs. Courtney." "Tara," Tara corrected her quickly. Nobody had used her surname since she had left Cape Town, and it sounded a jarring note in her own ears. The girl smiled shyly in acknowledgement. She had the serene beauty of a black Madonna, the classic moon face of the high-bred Zulu, with huge almond eyes and full lips, her skin the colour of dark amber, her hair plaited into an intricate pattern of tiny curls over her skull. "Are you related to the Courtneys of Zululand?" she asked Tara. "Old General Sean Courtney and Sir Garrick Courtney of Tunuskral, near Ladyburg?" "Yes," Tara tried not to show the shock she felt at the mention of those names. "Sir Garrick was my husband's grandfather. My own sons are named Sean and Garrick after them. Why do you ask, Vicky? Do you know the family well?" "Oh, yes, Mrs. Courtney. Tara." When she smiled, the Zulu girl's face seemed to glow like a dark moon. "Long ago, during the last century, my grandfather fought at General Sean Courtney's side in the Zulu Wars against Cetshwayo, who stole the kingship of Zululand from my family. It was my grandfather, Imbijan, who should have been king. Instead, he became General Courtney's servant. Imbijan, Tara cried. Oh, yes. Sir Garrick Courtney wrote about him in his History of Zululand. He was Sean Courtney's faithful retainer until his death. I remember they came up here to the goldfields of the reef together and later went on to what is now Rhodesia, hunting ivory. You know all about that, Vicky laughed with pleasure. My father used to tell me the same stories when I was a little girl. My father still lives near Tunis Kraal. After my grandfather, Imbijan Dini Zulu, died, my father took his place as the old general's body servant. He even went to France with the general in 1916 and worked for him until the general was murdered. In his will, the general left him a section of Tunis Kraal for his lifetime and a pension of £1,000 a year. They are a fine family, the Courtneys. My old father still weeps whenever he mentions the general's name. Vicky broke off and shook her head, suddenly perplexed and saddened. Life must have been so simple in those days. My grandfather and my father were hereditary chieftains, and yet they were satisfied to spend their lives subservient to a white man. And strangely, they loved that man, and he in his way seemed to love them. I wonder sometimes if theirs was not the better way. Do not even think that, Tara almost hissed at her. The Courtneys have always been heartless robber barons, plundering and exploiting your people. Right and justice are on the side of your struggle. Never entertain the slightest doubt of that. You are right, Vicky agreed firmly. But sometimes it's nice to think of the friendship of the general and my grandfather. Perhaps one day we could be friends again. Equal friends. Both sides stronger for the friendship. With every new oppression, with every new law passed, the prospect fades, Tara said grimly, and I become more ashamed of my race. I don't want to be sad and intense tonight, Tara. Let's talk about happy things. You said you have sons, Sean and Garrick, named after their ancestors. Tell me about them, please. However, the thought of the children and Shaza and Veltefrieden made Tara feel guilty and uncomfortable, and as soon as she could, she changed the subject again. Now tell me about yourself, Vicky, she insisted. What are you doing in Johannesburg, so far from Zululand? I work at Baragwanath Hospital, Vicky told her. Tara knew that was one of the largest hospitals in the world, certainly the largest in the Southern Hemisphere, with 2,400 beds and over 2,000 nurses and doctors, most of them black, for the hospital catered exclusively for black patients. All hospitals, like schools and transport and most other public facilities, were strictly segregated by law, true to the grand concept of apartheid. Vicky Dini Zulu was so modest about her own achievements that Tara had to draw out of her the fact that she was a qualified theatre sister. But you were so young, Vicky, she protested. There are others younger, the Zulu girl laughed. Her laughter had a pleasing musical lilt. She really is a lovely child, Tara thought, smiling in sympathy, and then corrected herself. No, not a child. A clever and competent young woman. So Tara told her about her clinic at Nyanga and the problems of malnutrition and ignorance and poverty they encountered. And Vicky related some of her experiences and the solutions they had found to the terrible challenges that faced them in caring for the physical well-being of a peasant population trying to adapt to an urban existence. Oh, I have enjoyed talking to you, Vicky blurted out at last. I don't know when I have ever spoken to a white woman like this before, so natural and relaxed and... She hesitated. Just like an elder sister or a dear friend. A dear friend. Yes, I like that, Tara agreed. And Puck's Hill is probably one of the few places in the whole of this country where we could meet and talk like this. Involuntarily, both of them looked up towards the head of the long kitchen table. Moses Gama was watching them intently, and Tara felt her stomach flop over like a stranded fish. For a few moments there, she had been totally engrossed with the Zulu girl. But now her feelings for Moses Gama flooded back at full ebb. She forgot Vicky until the girl spoke quietly beside her. He is a great man, our hope for the future. Tara glanced at her sideways. Vicky Dinizulu's face glowed with hero worship as she smiled shyly at Moses Gama. And jealousy struck Tara such a sickening blow in the pit of her stomach that for a moment she believed she was going to be physically ill. The jealousy and terror of imminent separation persisted even after Tara was alone with Moses that night. When he made love to her, she wanted to hold him within her for all eternity, knowing that this was the only time that he truly belonged to her. Too soon she felt the great dam burst and flood her, and she cried out, pleading for it never to end. But her cry was incoherent and without sense, and then he was gone from within her, and she was desolated. She thought he had fallen asleep, and she lay and listened to his quiet breathing, holding him in the circle of her arms. But he was awake, and he spoke suddenly, startling her. "You were speaking to Victoria Dinizulu," he said, and it took an effort for her to cast her mind back to the early part of the evening. "What did you think of her?" he persisted. "She's a lovely young woman, intelligent and obviously dedicated. I like her very much." She tried to be objective, but the sick, jealous feeling was there deep in her belly. "I had her invited," Moses said. "It was the first time I have met her." Tara wanted to ask, "Why? Why did you invite her?" But she remained silent, dreading the reply. She knew her instincts had been correct. "She is of the royal house of Zulu," he said softly. "Yes, she told me," Tara whispered. "She is well favored, as I was told she was, and her mother had many sons. They breed many sons in the Dinizulu line. She will make a good wife." "Wife?" Tara breathed. She had not expected that. "I need the alliance with the Zulus. They are the largest and most powerful tribe. I will begin the negotiations with her family immediately. I will send Hendrik to Leidenburg to see her father and make the arrangements. It will be difficult. He is one of the old school, dead set against mixed tribal marriages. It must be a wedding that will impress the tribe, and Hendrik will convince the old man of the wisdom of it."
But, Tara found she was stuttering. "You hardly know the girl. You spoke barely a dozen words to her all evening."
"What does that have to do with it?" His tone was genuinely puzzled, and he rolled away from her and switched on the bedside light, dazzling her. "Look at me," he commanded, taking her by the chin and lifting her face to the light, studying it for a moment, and then removing his fingers as though he had touched something loathsome. "I have misjudged you," he said scornfully. "I believed that you were an exceptional person, a true revolutionary, a dedicated friend of the black people of this land, ready to make any sacrifice. Instead, I find a weak, jealous woman, riddled with bourgeois white prejudices." The mattress tipped under her as Moses stood up. He towered over the bed. "I have been wasting my time," he said, gathering his clothing, and still naked, turned towards the door. Tara threw herself across the room and clung to him, barring his way to the door. I'm sorry, I didn't mean it. Forgive me, please, please forgive me," she pleaded with him, and he stood cold and aloof and silent. She began to weep, her tears muffling her voice, until she was no longer making sense. Slowly she slid down with her arms still encircling him, until she was on her knees, hugging his legs. "Please," she sobbed. "I'll do anything, just don't leave me. I'll do anything, everything you tell me to do, only just don't send me away like this." "Get up," he said at last, and when she stood before him like a penitent, he said softly, "You have one more chance, just one. Do you understand?" And she nodded wildly, still choking on her sobs, unable to answer him. She reached out hesitantly, and when he did not pull away, took his hand and led him back to the bed. As he mounted her again, he knew that at last she was ready, completely prepared. She would do anything and everything he commanded.